Please be seated. We're delighted to welcome you to the courthouse this morning. We're especially delighted to have two student groups, one from Walpon Area High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming this morning. You may be seated. And we have students from Randolph High School. Would they stand, please? Delighted to have you, too. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program entitled Court with Class. Students from all over the state are invited to join us for an oral argument, and if they do come, they're given materials about the case we are about to hear. They may engage in activities relating to this case, and then they come and hear an oral argument. And part of the program is that they will stay, and after the second oral argument at about noon, they will meet with a justice who will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substance of the cases we have heard. So let me now introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice... He's not gone. He's left. I guess he didn't come out. He is not participating in this case. So he is not seated. The chair is empty, which you can all observe. The ever-vanishing. Seated next to the empty chair is Justice Patience Wilkinson. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. My immediate right is Justice Ian Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I will call our first case, 07AP400CR, State versus Mark H, and is it pronounced Toddy or Toddy? Toddy. And arguing on behalf of Mr. Toddy is Byron Lichtstein. Mr. Lichtstein.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May I please report? When I first read the transcript of jury selection in this case, and learned that the trial judge's mother made it onto the jury, I was taken aback and chuckled a bit, because I had the intuitive sense that it didn't seem quite right. It appeared a bit questionable. And I suspect some or all of you may have had that same sense. The trial judge himself had that same sense. Although he denied the defense's motion to strike, he said, quote, "I'm not necessarily excited about having her on the panel, because I can see the possibility of questions arising. But I don't have any basis for kicking her off." Do this judge a favor. Do future judges in this position a favor. Don't make them wrestle with having to evaluate the impartiality and independence of their own family members. Give them a way to say, "Mom, Dad, I think you can be perfectly fair and impartial, but the law says I can't do that." Give them a way to avoid the discomfort this judge felt in having to evaluate his own immediate family member.
Would you stop at Mom and Dad?
Your Honor, I believe the test I've proposed in my brief is immediate family members, which I would include children and brothers and sisters. In Gesch, you'll note that the per se rule imposed there required family members to the third degree. I think, obviously, that'll be a question for you, but in my brief, I'd confine it to immediate family members to make the universe of people excluded a bit smaller.
So not brothers-in-law and sisters-in-law? But
I would include those. I would include any variation of half-brother, step-brother as well. I think giving judges in this position a way out of this situation will not only protect the constitutional rights of criminal defendants, but it will also say something very important about the integrity of our jury system and our judicial process. It will protect that appearance of absolute propriety that's so essential to the functioning of our system.
Counsel, you say give judges a way out. That's an umbrella argument to two discrete arguments that are set forth, among others, in your brief. Do we give judges a way out in terms of not being confronted with the recusal motion? Does one necessarily fit the other? In other words, you've got the first issue in this case, as I hear it anyway, was he deprived of his right because the jury wasn't independent, and then as an alternative, the juror was biased, right? That's the first argument. Second argument you have is that the judge should have recused himself. Let me restate my question. Which of those two arguments is the stronger argument for you?
Your Honor, as my brief makes clear, I think there are several ways to resolve this, several ways to look at this issue. I think perhaps the simplest approach here might be to view this as a straightforward application of the objective bias test in Foucher, along the lines of Gesch, which Foucher expressly sort of reinterpreted as an application of the objective bias standard, the new standard articulated in Foucher. If, however, as I've suggested in my brief, this issue falls outside of Foucher because it seems to deal with the issue of independence rather than bias, then I think there's a way to view this as a constitutional issue that just wasn't covered by the Foucher case. Now, getting more to the last part of your question, recusal, I think, is yet a separate way to look at the issue. If we view it not as a Foucher question and not as an independent constitutional issue outside of Foucher, I think there is that other way to view the issue, and that is to see it as a situation where the judge simply should not be presiding over a motion to strike his own mother, and that recusal would be an appropriate remedy in that circumstance.
Sometimes I talk about leading with my right, or you should lead with your right, but that is what's your strongest. Of those three, which one are you leading with?
Well, I have to say that as I prepared for this argument, my thinking on this did evolve a bit. I would say that perhaps the simplest way to resolve this, the simplest way to understand it, is as an application of Foucher's objective bias test.
Okay. Well, I have problems with that, so maybe it isn't so simple. Why is this juror objectively biased? You read the transcript, so did I. Questions were asked of her. Now, I know that goes to the subject of her responses, but why would I have to find her objectively biased for or against the defendant based on this transcript?
Well, if you look at the language in Foucher that discusses what the objective bias test is all about, it's about making sure we have jurors who are impartial. And how they define impartial is as a juror who will decide the case based on the evidence. And I think what we have here with a close familial relationship between the judge and juror is a great risk that that juror is going to decide the case based on some impression communicated non-verbally, unintentionally, by the judge. And so I think when you have that risk, the risk of a juror that's going to decide the case based on something other than the evidence, and in this case, what I'm getting at is the possibility of, the heightened possibility of judicial influence, then you're dealing with a situation that does fit squarely within objective bias. And Gesch, I think, is the template that you can follow on that. Although Gesch was decided before Foucher, it has been interpreted as an objective bias case. And I think resolving the case in this way is in some sense simpler because it does not require you to recognize an independent constitutional claim outside Foucher. Now, let me be clear.
I have to ask you this. You said there could be some communication that she could understand from the judge. That could happen with any juror, potentially. Take away the element of his mother being on the case. Was there anything about the judge, in and of just the judge, that would cause you to believe this judge would not be fair and impartial in this case, if the mother weren't on the jury?
Well, I have several answers to that question. First of all, I'm not raising an independent claim of judicial bias, as you know from the briefs. So I guess I don't have an opinion on whether an argument for judicial bias would or would not carry the day. However, I do think, as I pointed out in the briefs, that the judge's comment during voir dire, when he said, "I like to consider myself part of law enforcement or I may be disowned," I think that does evidence a pro-prosecution stance towards the case, and it says something about his family's orientation towards the case, but it also creates a risk that jurors who are in that unfamiliar position of serving on a jury and are looking for cues about how to interpret this situation. They're in a place where they really don't quite know how to go and how to act. The judge is the primary authority in the courtroom, and making a comment like that, I think there is a great risk that comment will skew the jury. And I've spelled out in my brief several authorities suggesting as much. But, Your Honor, going back to your point that any juror, that there could be nonverbal communication between the judge and any juror, I think it's important to recognize that with an immediate family member, that kind of communication is much, much more likely. Immediate family members are in a much better position not only to perceive the judge's nonverbal cues, but to understand them and then to follow them.
I was just trying to get at your argument that somehow the judge would communicate something to the mother. I mean, if a judge is going to do that, you've got a problem regardless. A judge can't communicate with a jury on telling them how to decide a case. So I was trying to figure out where the bias of the judge came in, and you're saying through the law enforcement comment.
Well, I'm not sure I'm understanding you correctly. I apologize.
In order for her to be influenced by the judge would have to be pro one way or the other, instead of a fair, neutral, unbiased, detached arbiter of the dispute, right? Just ruling on objections. The judge doesn't decide guilt or innocence. The judge decides evidentiary rulings. The judge reads the jury instructions. The judge does a variety of things, but sort of keeps the trial going. It's the jury's job to decide who they believe, who they don't believe, what weight they want to attach to the evidence. And they alone reach a conclusion. So I was trying to get a firm grasp on what it was you thought the judge was communicating to the mother such that it would taint her ability to be fair and impartial.
Well, obviously I don't know what the judge might have been communicating in this case because it doesn't appear in the record. But that doesn't mean it didn't happen, and it's not at all difficult to imagine. For instance, perhaps when the judge doesn't believe what a witness is saying, he gets a little bit restless, starts shuffling around the papers on his desk. Well, some jurors might see that, pick up on it, but they wouldn't know what it means. The mother may very well know what that means. She's in a position to understand what the judge's nonverbal behavior indicates, and it doesn't need to be conscious, intentional communication.
Okay.
Counsel, thank you. It seems to me you're talking about not necessarily bias, but some difficulties that may ensue because the relationship exists. I look at the Foucher case, and it discusses Gesch, and it says our holding in Gesch is unique. Gesch remains an example that some relationships are so fraught with the possibility of bias that we must find objective bias regardless of the surrounding circumstances. And I'm just not sure that your having your mother on the jury is so fraught with the possibility that she may be an unfair juror, a biased juror. As it is, it's just fraught with possibility of complications.
Well, I think that's true. It is fraught with possibility and complications, and that
we have here. The reason that we're here, this is a little bit complicated. I mean, and the judge himself said that, you know, what's going to happen if there is an accusation of juror misconduct, and then I have to rule on the juror misconduct accusation of my own mother. Do we bring in a substitute judge? You know, it's going to be a mistrial. What's going on here? You know.
I think, Your Honor, that the concept of an impartial juror is a bit broader than simply a juror who has an obvious bias towards one of the parties. And as I was alluding to earlier, I think what Foucher says when it's discussing the concept of an impartial juror, what they mean is a juror that is able and likely to decide the case based on the evidence. And what occurs when you have an immediate family member of the judge on the jury is you have a juror who is likely to be picking up on cues from the judge. Again, not necessarily intentional or overt cues, but is likely to be able to see what the judge's impressions of a particular witness or of the case overall are and to follow those.
Is there any indication here that that happened?
There's no indication in the record of that, Your Honor, but I think it's not difficult to imagine, again, of ways in which that might happen. For instance, perhaps there's a given judge that leans back in his or her chair during when a particular attorney is talking. And perhaps most jurors wouldn't know what that reaction means. But an immediate family member will be able to pick up on those cues. And having picked up on them, will be likely to follow them.
Well, it seems to me that you can foresee very easily issues that involve the mother and the son, the judge. You don't have to wait until the trial ends and you got an accusation of jury misconduct, because during a trial, judges make rulings and objections. Lawyers sometimes express displeasure in one form or other. Lawyers might engage in conversation with the judge, which to some people might appear disrespectful or confrontational, but might be acceptable courtroom behavior. And what you've got is a mom sitting there who may or may not be protective of her. To her, he's still 15. He may be 60, but to her, he's still 15, and may very well come to his defense or feel that he has not been appropriately treated, which raises problems about how she's going to view the case, or with her there, raises these issues for other jurors who all know that she's the mother, right? They've all heard her, the judge, say, "That's my mom."
I think you're correct, Your Honor, and if you carry that forward to deliberations, and you think what's going on in the deliberation room when the other jurors know that this one juror is the judge's mother, it makes it unlikely that those jurors are going to be willing to disagree vigorously with the mother, to go against her view, not only because they may think she has some special understanding of the case, but also because they just may not want to draw the ire of an immediate family member of the judge.
If you wish, to move on to the independence concept. I find this an interesting issue. On the one hand, the reason you have a jury is to bring in the people of the community to sit in judgment, and it is, among many things, a protection against a judge, a single judge, who might be biased, who might have a personal agenda, who any number of reasons might be a part of the government. He is part of the government, as we all are. So you want the jury in there as a protection, a bulwark against this. So in that sense, the jury is independent, to be independent of the judge. On the other hand, the jury is very dependent on the judge. The jury is required to hear and obey the legal instructions, the instructions of law, right? And so how does that play out when mom's on the jury? That you want the jury to be independent, and yet the jury is not independent. It's a mixed bag there.
Well, I think the way that plays out is that we have quite tight controls on the interactions between judge and jury. As you point out, Your Honor, it's very clear from the history, both our federal and state constitutions, that what our framers were talking about when they created the right to an impartial jury was a jury independent of the judge. So it's very clear that that's a principle that the framers wanted to uphold. And you're also correct, Your Honor, that they did fear, part of what they were afraid of at that point was the possibility of judges too biased towards the state, the likelihood that a judge being part of the government might be biased toward the state, and so the jury was viewed as a double security. How does that interact with the fact that there is and needs to be some interaction between judge and jury? I think the answer to that is essentially that there should be, as far as the jury panel is concerned, an entirely independent panel. A panel that, although it will have to have some interaction with the judge, it will be in a position to still decide the case as independently as possible from the judge. And when you have an immediate family member on the jury, an immediate family member of the judge on the jury, you're not dealing with a panel that's able to ignore and go beyond that possibility for judicial influence.
Why shouldn't we just have a court add, either under bias or independence, the concept that first, I think it's the first jury disqualification relating to third-degree family members, why shouldn't we just add the judge to that list of people?
I think that's one option, Your Honor. And I certainly think there are good arguments for following that option. My only point is I don't think you need to go there to decide this case. I think you can decide this case in a less, with a less, I guess, sweeping holding under Foucher's objective bias test, because in two ways, this was a jury that was likely not independent of the judge and therefore not impartial as that term is understood in Foucher.
Yeah, on the other hand, when you have a bright line rule and can count the degrees, which is not always easy, frankly, never do understand how you do the count, but if you can count the degrees, you got a bright line rule and you can handle it. Now, it may be over-inclusive, but there's something to be said for giving the judge a rule that says, hey, you get any relative like this in the pool, you ought to strike them or strike yourself. I mean, those are the two choices. And to make it simple and avoid litigation is a, I think, commendable position.
I agree, Your Honor, that there certainly is much virtue in a bright line rule. However, I would point out that if this court were to write an opinion concluding that the juror in this case was objectively biased under Foucher, and if that holding relied heavily on the fact that the juror was an immediate family member of the judge, not creating a per se exclusion there, but relying heavily on that fact, I think the likelihood is that that would operate in practice as a per se exclusion. I think the trial judges in the state would get the message that this is not a good idea.
Are you making the argument not to adopt a per se rule because if I were reading the cases cold, the court keeps saying, well, we don't like per se rules. We don't like per se rules. Is that why you're making that argument?
In part, but also because I think In general, it's easier to decide a case under an existing framework, which is the Foucher framework, rather than to have to recognize some additional part of that framework. However, I don't want to give the impression that I think a per se rule is a bad idea. I think that is certainly one option, and there are very good arguments, as you've articulated and as I've articulated in part in my brief, for following that option.
If there aren't any more questions on that area, let's go to recusal. That is that there was error because the judge did not recuse himself when presented with a motion to strike his mother from the jury panel.
Your Honor, there are two ways that I think this recusal argument can go. The first is under Wisconsin's statute, which, as you know, requires recusal when the judge makes a subjective determination that he can't or can't appear to be impartial. And I think the judge made such a determination. As you alluded to earlier, he, in looking at the issue involving his mother, he said, quote, "I'm trying to go through the potential problems in my mind. Are there potential problems with misconduct? Might I be called into a position where I'd have to rule on some type of misconduct? I think the thing to do at that point is get a substitute judge." That is, in substance, a determination that I, as the judge, should not be ruling on issues involving my mother. And I think that there's really no... the situation that the judge was in is essentially indistinguishable from the situation that he contemplated. In order to rule on the motion to strike, he had to evaluate the voir dire responses of his own mother. And that's precisely the kind of determination that he was contemplating. Now,
you go on in that quote, though. It says, "I don't think I have a legal basis to excuse her, so I'm going to perhaps reluctantly deny your motion." Did the judge have a legal basis to excuse her?
I think the judge did, Your Honor. But I think, as I said at the start here, I think it would do this judge and future judges a favor to make very clear that that legal basis exists. And that's why I presented several options for how to get there, because I think there is a way to look at existing law. And the state has pointed this out in its brief, there is a way to look at existing law as not covering this situation. And that, I assume, is why the judge here took the view that he did. I see that my light is on. Did you have a question, Your Honor?
Yes. Suppose the judge had struck his mother. Are you arguing that he didn't have the authority? He should have recused himself from that decision?
Suppose he had struck his mother? Well, Your Honor, I think there were a couple of ways to go for the judge here. He could have erred on the side of caution and granted the motion to strike. In the alternative, I think he could have said to himself, "I'm really not in the position to make this decision, and therefore I'm going to step aside and not make it."
Well, this is Ashland County, isn't it?
It is.
This is the day of the jury trial?
It is.
So they'd have to delay the jury trial, bring in a judge from another county? Does that sound practical?
Your Honor, I agree that the impracticality of that option is certainly a downside. That's why I think it probably makes more sense to decide the case as a matter of whether the juror should have been impaneled on the jury rather than as a recusal issue. However, I do think the recusal argument has something to be said for it as well, the impracticality aside.
Is your argument on recusal due process, or is it statutory, or both?
Both, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. William J. Gansner, Assistant Attorney General, Counsel for the State of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court. Mr. Lichtenstein said that when he first heard of this case, when it first came to his attention, one of his first impressions was how odd the case was. I must admit, in the interest of full disclosure, the first reaction I had when I saw Mr. Lichtenstein's brief was to think of if I recall it correctly, when I Googled it, a 19th century English kind of nonsense rhyme song that included the refrain, "A boy's best friend is his mother."
Nonsense about that. Well, you may be seated.
Then it occurred to me what a controversial conclusion that was, and perhaps that's why it was in the song that it was in. What I believe the defendant is arguing for in his argument for a per se rule or for a more limited ruling from this court, asking this court to conclude that Miss Eaton was objectively biased and should have been struck, is, as Mr. Lichtenstein candidly acknowledged, a rule that would help judges get off the hook, to save them from a difficult situation. I would suggest to this court, and this is the point we have tried to press in our brief, that existing law provides for the means by which a judge can deal with what I think must be regarded as the unusual and uncommon circumstance that was presented in this case, arising in courts of this state, without creating a categorical rule contrary to, I think, numerous decisions of this court, suggesting that this court is not particularly interested, and wisely so, I believe, in creating new categories, new categorical exclusions of jury duty.
Mr. Hansner,
yes.
As I heard Mr. Lichtenstein's argument, he said you don't have to create a new category. You don't have to do anything but apply Futcher.
Right.
That mom is on the jury, and that she would have a bias towards the judge. That the judge is in the courtroom at all times. The judge makes rulings. The judge handles a whole variety of matters. Sometimes the jury is happy with what the judge does. Sometimes it's not. And sometimes the unhappiness can be whether the judge gives them a bathroom break timely or gives them a lunch break timely or what the judge orders for lunch. It could be any number of things. And you got mom sitting in the jury, and the jury might be, she's biased. I mean, she's biased if she loves him, and she's biased if she doesn't. Either way. And I don't know too many neutral moms. So you got a problem. And you don't know how that's going to all react. Now, when I was in practice, a judge in this community had a trial. One of my law partners was one of the lawyers. And the judge would have the trial for an hour and then break it and have other things and keep doing this, and made some rulings about when the jury should come back, and one of the juries balked at what the judge's ruling is about what time they come back. It was very inconvenient for the juror, and that the juror felt that the judge was just running the whole thing on the basis of what's convenient for him.
And the judge in that case called for a mistrial on the basis of bias to the judge. Yeah, that's what he did. So these things can happen, and what you have here is mom sitting on that jury with all of these potential issues. Why do you think that an objective bias test and the future is not a good one here?
Let me make sure that the state's position here is clear. We think that the objective bias test of Foucher and Foucher provides the means whereby these kind of claims ought to be decided, and that under that test, Judge Eaton was right in saying there were no legal grounds for disqualifying his mother from jury duty.
So your position is, as a matter of law per se, a close family member of the judge is not disqualified.
Any more so than a police officer or a government employee should per se be regarded as disqualified from jury duty in a criminal case or in a case where the government is involved as a party. We don't believe that a categorical exclusion of a juror because of relationship to the judge is warranted, required under Wisconsin law, or warranted by the change, or that a change in Wisconsin law to embrace it, as argued by the defendant, is justified in this case. We believe instead that Future does provide the framework by which these admittedly difficult, but also concededly uncommon and rare circumstances can be adequately dealt with. And I think that this case represents Judge Eaton dealing with what Mr. Lichtenstein has I think fairly described as a difficult decision to make. But we don't need a per se rule to let judges off the hook when to make life easier for them when they have tools available to them now by which in the exercise of their discretion and their understanding of what is happening in their courtroom and the evaluation of answers from prospective jurors, they can make fair, considered, and reasonable decisions.
Judge Eaton said, "I can't find a rule to strike you, so you're on the jury, Mom." Is that the law, that unless there's a law or rule or statute or case that requires disqualification, you can't disqualify the mother?
Well, if there is not a strong legal basis upon which the judge's decision can be grounded, and if a judge were to conclude that his decisions are to be based on something other than the law, then I think we'd be acknowledging that the law is nothing more than a collection of the biases of judges. They're subjective conclusions. But I believe that judges, and Judge Eaton in this case, was attempting and succeeded in deciding this case on the basis of the law and fairly exercised his discretion in doing so.
I recently had an opportunity to review a case that deals with this issue. Mm-hmm. The very one you're talking about, the one that the chief question was focused on. Let me restate what I understand the question to be, and that is that the three-part test of Foucher on bias, on juror bias, is that the sole means by which a judge can remove a juror?
Well, under existing law, I struggle to find what another ground or basis upon which the judge could conclude. If he is not to look to the existing law, as Judge Eaton did in this case, I'm not quite sure if we're saying he's adrift and can tie his reasoning to anything.
A recent Court of Appeals case began its analysis by noting that the fundamental principle that a trial court has the obligation to uphold the integrity of jury trials and to ensure a fair
and non-biased jury. So as I see it, there's a bigger umbrella here. It is to uphold the integrity of the jury trial. Part of that is to make sure you don't have a biased juror. Let's say you have a case where a judge removes a juror, not because the juror is biased, not because the juror meets any of the three part test of Fosher, but because the juror maybe is chosen as an, the judge makes the juror as an alternate, as a choice for an alternate juror, because one of the witnesses says, hey, that juror doesn't recognize me. Or the judge knows that juror doesn't recognize one of the witnesses. We went to school together. But the judge is concerned if during the course of the trial the juror's mind is all of a sudden jogged and remembers the relationship, then, oh, we've got a problem. We might have a problem. So doesn't the judge have authority to try to circumvent potential jury problems, even if those it doesn't appear in the three-part test of Fosher?
If I understand your question correctly, Mr. Bradley, this relationship between the prospective juror who becomes an alternate juror and a witness is something that was brought to the attention during voir dire?
The judge found out that the this information, see, I don't know if it was during voir dire or if it was during the course of the trial. I think it was during the course of the trial. It probably had 13 jurors sitting, and then the judge named that juror as the alternate and then ultimately dismissed that juror because of that basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it arising during trial obviously presents a more difficult problem for the judge, but if we can try to analogize that situation to this, if the judge found out about that relationship during the course of voir dire, without knowing more about what the extent of that relationship was, I think the thing to do at that time was to confront the juror to make sure that everybody knew what the relationship was.
It happened and during the course of trial. Does the court have authority to designate that person as the alternate and then remove when 13
If the judge believes, based upon a mid-trial evaluation and questioning of the relevant people involved, the juror, and determines what the nature of the relationship was, if the judge determines on the basis of that information that this is a circumstance in which either subjective or objective bias under Foucher is present, then yes, the judge would certainly be entitled.
The short answer to my long question, and I apologize for that, is that a court is limited to the three tests in Fosher to remove a juror. Is that what you're saying? That's the only legal basis.
What I'm saying is that under current existing Wisconsin law, that provides the framework within which a judge can make the decision, but I think it's not a straitjacket. It's not a narrowly drawn and confining box. We've got three different categories,
okay.
And the latter two, subjective and objective, provide a very broad range of determination within which a judge.
Regardless of how broad or how narrow those boxes are, your answer is it is those three boxes that are the sole area upon which a judge can legally discharge a juror.
Right. And I would add to that an interpretive principle that this court announced in the Lindell case, where the court suggested that urged judges to err on the side of striking jurors who appear to be biased. This court did not say that judges should err on the side of striking jurors whenever a claim of possible bias is raised, whenever a party to the action says, this could be a problem, but this court urged judges to err on the side of striking jurors when, in the judge's consideration of the circumstances, it appears that the juror is biased, or that there's a considerable possibility that the juror would be biased. So in the example that you suggested, Justice Bradley, if the judge learned in advance of trial about the relationship, previously undisclosed or unacknowledged relationship between a witness and a juror, if after examining, finding out more of what the circumstances was, what the circumstances were, the judge determined that this is a case where it appeared that the juror was biased, or was likely to be biased, it would be entirely appropriate for the judge.
And if the court didn't engage in any further inquiry, but simply instruct the juror, you would think that that might be an error.
I think that would be problematic. Now, we know what, of course, happened in this case. There was a considerable questioning when the defense counsel had his opportunity to question the juror during voir dire. He said, oh boy, you bet I have some questions. And he fired off a series of questions to the jurors, and most particularly for our purpose, to Ms. Eaton, to ask her about her ability to serve impartially on the jury, and whether or not the fact that the presiding judge was her son would have any influence on her whatsoever. There were no restraints whatsoever put on defense counsel, or the prosecutor for that matter, to phrase or pose as many questions as they wished to the jurors, including Ms. Eaton, on her ability, with respect to her ability to quiz her on her ability to serve impartially. And defense counsel's response to that was an acknowledgement that there was no observation, no demonstration by Ms. Eaton of any subjective bias. In fact, later we know he did not choose, was not required that he do so, but he did not choose to exercise any peremptory challenges, any of his four peremptories, against Ms. Eaton. And later, in a post-conviction motion hearing, when asked why he didn't exercise a peremptory to strike this juror, which would have prevented, had he done so, all of the time that we are now spending on this case, he said, because there were four others that I thought more appropriately should be struck.
Counselor, I'm very interested in the argument that a jury is provided for, at least in part, to separate the interests of the government from the people, and that somehow the judge is seen as part of government. And if you have the judge's mom on the jury, then you don't get the kind of separation that's raised as a concern sometimes. What's your best argument on why I shouldn't think that was an argument that would allow your opponent to prevail this morning?
Okay, two things, Your Honor. I think at the core of the defendant's argument about the need for a jury that is independent of the judge is the notion that the relationship between judge and juror here, mother-son relationship, is one that would make this particular juror subject to undue influence by the judge. That's a curious argument, because the role of the judge at a trial, if he or she is to exert influence at all, is a strong influence over maintaining the fairness and impartiality of the proceedings, not to tilt towards one party or the other. So the concern that the defense has that this juror, or any juror, might have been unduly influenced by the judge strikes me as largely illusory. If the judge is running this trial, as I believe he did, fairly and impartially, in his rulings and in his instructions to the jury, and there's no challenge to any of the instructions that the jury was given here, then the influence that the judge would have over the jurors was to make sure that they engaged, exercised their responsibilities in an impartial fashion that favored neither the government or the defense. And in fact, that was a point that was strongly made, most strongly made in the record of this case, not by the judge, not by the prosecutor, but by defense counsel. In his own questioning, voir dire questioning, of the jury and his statements to the jury, which, as voir dire sometimes does, turns from questions posed to individual jurors to statements directed to all of the jurors. When, after the judge made the comment about being a part of law enforcement, or asked a question of the jurors, are any of you related to someone who's in a law enforcement related capacity? And he said, I like to think that I am. And his mother, which was apparently a comment directed at his mother, no one was hiding anything about who she was, and she said, yes, my son is the judge. She answered, yes, I am related to someone who is in a law enforcement related capacity, the judge. It was defense counsel who said, law enforcement doesn't mean the state only. It doesn't mean the prosecution. I'm the defense attorney. My job here is to serve the interests of my client. And I'm part of law enforcement. Well, it is my job to seek to make sure that the law is followed and in that sense enforced. So it's not, we have defense counsel who is clearly not a part of government saying, all of us are serving the cause of law enforcement.
I understand what defense counsel said. My concern rises from the mom's response, which is really closely in time given to when the judge says he's part of law enforcement. And then the mom says, well, she's related to someone who's involved in law enforcement. And that connection gives me cause or concern for this particular trial because, perhaps she sees the position of law enforcement as always being more meritorious because her son has announced that he's part of that position. Do you know what's kind of bothering me with that?
I do understand what you're saying, and I guess the point I'm trying to make is that as I see Mr. Lichtenstein's argument, and I appreciate the historical survey that he has provided about the development of the jury system and the importance of juries being independent of a government, is that the most important development in the course of creating, I think, in my view, a jury system in which we ensure that jurors are independent of the government is the development of and the firm protection of the right of a defendant to a jury composed of a fair cross-section of the community, not a jury dominated by the government, not a jury selected by the government, but a jury selected through a process in which both the government, neither the government nor the defense have any control over who's on the jury panel, and in which both the government and the defense have an opportunity to quiz the members of the panel and select a jury that both sides have an opportunity to make sure will be fair and impartial. And it's the judge's obligation as the referee of the proceedings to make sure that that's what's happening. Yes. This was not a jury that was hand-selected by the government or by the state.
No, but the other part of it that bothers me is if you got jurors, I haven't looked at the record, and I don't know if it says or not, but just say these are all new jurors. They've never been on a jury before. And you got the judge's mom as one of the jurors, and she thinks his position is aligned with law enforcement. It seems to me that you could make a very significant argument that she could certainly lead that jury in a way that none of the other jurors may be able to do. Now, to some degree, it's dependent on the personalities of the folks that are there, because you don't know what other alpha pups you got in the lot and what other followers you have in the jury pool. But the danger is troublesome when you combine the statement that he's part of law enforcement, yeah, that's, I'm related to someone in law enforcement, and then she's the judge's mom. These jurors don't know quite what's cooking, and maybe they think somehow she knows more just because she happens to be related to someone who's a judge.
Yeah, and I can only respond to that by suggesting again that when the judge properly asked of the jury panel, Are any of you related to someone who is, works in or is involved in a law enforcement related capacity? That was after he had asked, are any of you related to someone who works for a sheriff's office or a police department? Then there was the broader question asked, anyone related to anyone who works in a law enforcement related capacity, expanding from police or prosecutor to the larger area in which people might more commonly and generically use the term law enforcement to relate to things other than just the agencies of police investigation. And she properly answered the question, yes, and the judge acknowledged, the judge led, it was a leading question, when he said, I like to think that I'm involved in law enforcement. And in the same way that the defense counsel understood that question, the judge, I think, was simply saying, as a judge whose responsibility is to make sure that the law is followed, in that broad sense, I'm a part of law enforcement. And I think that's an absolutely accurate statement.
Mr. Gannon.
The understanding of what it meant was assisted by what defense counsel then made clear to the jury, that all of us here who have a role are involved in law enforcement.
Justice Prosser has a question.
Suppose Mrs. Eaton had lived at the home of her son. Same result from your viewpoint?
I think that would be an additional fact not present in this case that would raise more concern. Yes.
Well, where did she live?
We don't know. It wasn't a subject of inquiry. Could have been, wasn't. Well, I take that back. I don't know that it's in the record. I suspect that the clerk's office would have had in the jury information, the addresses of everyone, so it was knowable, and I suspect
but
that information available to counsel.
If Mrs. Eaton lived with the judge, that would raise some eyebrows in your...
Especially about the danger of communication during a trial.
Well, they did live in Ashland County, and Ashland County isn't that big.
And a big area, but not a big...
There's a fair chance they live pretty close to each other. You cited the Lindell case, which I have some familiarity with.
Yes.
And in that case, there is a passage. It is the appearance of partiality that gives great pause. Jurors must not only be fair and impartial, they must also not have a relationship to either side, which leaves doubt about their impartiality. And that's in the very paragraph that talks about, come on, judges, use some sound discretion here. Get rid of the problems, because such action will avoid the appearance of bias and may save judicial time and resources in the long run. Now, just frankly, if we were to say, it's okay to have the judge's mother on the jury panel. What's the next case?
His wife. His father.
Well, father.
I mean, let's go through the family tree. I mean, that's sure. Those are possibilities. Of course.
Well, okay. Opposing counsel made an argument about non-verbal communication. And it might even be subconscious nonverbal communication. In other words, eyebrow goes up. I mean, who can read those reactions from the judge better than the judge's mother?
She certainly may have a leg up on others in being able to read them. Based upon long experience, that I acknowledge that, surely. Of course, what we can't ever know with certainty, and Mr. Lichtstein makes a point that, and this was his choice of words both in his brief and in his comments here, the argument this morning, that his goal is to achieve an absolute appearance of impartiality. I question whether or not an absolute state of certainty is ever possible in a jury system, whether jurors are related to the judge, or whether they've ever had any contact at all. I'm not sure that absolute state of certainty of impartiality is ever absolutely attainable. And I think it's critical that, with respect to Lindell, or this court's other cases dealing with jury impartiality, to recognize that those cases dealt with, overwhelmingly, circumstances in which a potential juror, was related to, or had some connection with, or some question arose as to their bias in favor or against a party. What we have in this case is a question of a potential juror's relationship not to a party, but to the presiding impartial figure at the trial.
Let me ask
one. And that makes all the difference, I believe.
Let me ask one more question, if I may. I think you were the one who indicated that the defense counsel did not strike Mrs. Eaton because the defense counsel didn't have a more pressing problem. Why didn't the prosecutor strike Mrs. Eaton?
I don't know the answer to that question, and the record doesn't tell us.
Is it possible that the prosecutor was afraid of the judge's reaction?
I can't answer that question.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Gantz.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Lichtenstein, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think there are two answers to your question, Justice Prosser. The first is the possibility that the prosecutor may not have wanted to incur the judge's wrath. The second is that perhaps he liked Juror Eaton as someone he wanted on the panel precisely because of what had occurred during voir dire. It had become clear that in that family, someone gets disowned if they don't consider themselves part of law enforcement. Now, of course, that's a joke, but it wouldn't surprise me if the prosecutor saw that exchange and liked the prospect of having her on the jury. Now, with respect to this issue of unintentional communication, this reminds me a little bit of my monthly poker game. Now, we all know that anybody who plays poker, people give off a lot of unintentional communication. What you're looking for when you play poker is people's tells. Not the things they say, I've got two aces or I've got three queens, but the way they move, the way they take off their sunglasses, the little nervous energy they give off. And when I played with my brother, I can tell you, I knew his tell. And I was going to use that tell when I had it. Now, the same thing carries over to this kind of a situation. The judge's mother would be the one who would know the judge's tells, not the ones he's trying to give off, but the ones he can't help but give off. And having picked up those tells, that juror is going to be unable to avoid using them. And I think the state gives altogether too little credit to the possibility that that unintentional communication has a substantial impact. Now, with respect to the state's comment that we have a set of tools, the Foucher categories, and that's all we need, that framework is working, that assertion is belied by what the trial judge in this case said. The trial judge in this case said, I don't feel good about this. I'm not comfortable having her on the jury, but I don't have a basis for kicking her off. The trial judge himself disagreed with what the state is saying here, and I think all this court needs to do is make it quite clear that there is a legal basis. And as I said earlier, that doesn't need to be a sweeping rule that disqualifies any immediate family member under all circumstances. It just needs to give the judge a hook, something that can allow him to say that his discomfort, what he felt in his gut that this didn't look right, that there is a legal basis supporting that. I think that the points I have made about unintentional communication and the possibility that the judge's mother may carry more weight during deliberations. Those are things that I think there's a good likelihood that they will happen. As the states pointed out, and as some of your questions suggest, they're not absolutely going to happen. But even if they don't happen, there will always be the appearance that those things happen, and therefore a suspicion that the process is not fair. Whether or not those things actually happen, there will be that suspicion that they did happen. And therefore, that will be a stain on the integrity of the process to anyone who happens to be sitting in the gallery watching what's going on. I think it's also worth pointing out that the process that the state wants to institutionalize here and is defending is one that does create a rather bizarre spectacle of trial judges having to sit and impart and assess the impartiality and independence of their own immediate family members. And I think if any of us reflect for a moment about being in that situation, I think it's quite clear how uncomfortable and difficult that would be. And I don't think we want to write into the law that that's the correct process that has to be followed, that judges have to sit and assess, okay, this is my mother, this is my father, can they be fair and impartial? It just strikes me as an assessment that we do not want to require judges in this state to make. With respect to the law enforcement comment, the state made several points suggesting that the comment was more general, that the question went to the law enforcement-related capacity rather than law enforcement. I think it's quite clear from the entire context that what was going on there is that the judge was telling the jury, I have to look at myself as one of the good guys, or it isn't okay in my family. He was expressly weighing in on one side. And I think that's really the only rational way to read this. And I see that my light is on, so if there are no questions, I'll wrap up.
I think we're finished. Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Lichtenstein, and thank you, Mr. Gansner, for yet another case involving juror and or judge bias and refusal. Now we conclude our hearing in 07-AP-400-CR, State versus Mark H. Tody, Jr. The court will take a recess so that if the students here are leaving, they may do so, and we have another group of students who wish to enter the courtroom. We are in recess for a couple of minutes.